Hello everyone, this is Incredible Fencing Podcast. For more information, you can visit my website, subscribe to my YouTube channel or Instagram page. Hey everyone, and welcome back to Incredible Fencing Podcast. My name is Taras, and today I invited another guest who is also a fencing coach and who is working in Chicago, Illinois. It's in United States. And my guest name is Edward Kaihatsu. He's been fencing pretty long time by himself, and he was attending many different fencing competitions in United States and abroad. So he's got a lot of experience as an athlete. Also, Edward is a fencing coach, so he is coaching many young people and many adults. And also, he's mentor and he helps fencing students and many people who are young and who wants to come to US. So he helps them to apply to US universities as a part of their fencing program. So if you have any plans to visit US as a student and you want to study in US, maybe you can contact Edward. I'm gonna tell his email at the end of this episode, and you can also find him in internet pretty easy. I think you can just Google him, you can find him in Facebook and many social media. So I think it's very easy in these modern times. All right, so our conversation will be pretty long, but if you want to listen just some part of our conversation, you can check the description where I'm gonna put some time tags with some key points we're gonna talk. So you can start from the middle, for example, and listen just to part of this episode. But I think if you listen the whole episode, it's gonna be a more complete, right? So hopefully it's gonna be interesting and useful for everybody who is listening. All right, so here is our conversation with Ed Kaihatsu. Hi Ed, how you been in Chicago?
Good. Okay. Just got buried in snow, but otherwise okay.
But do you like snow? I think it's very nice.
No. It's clean, it's fresh, it's fluffy, and it's very quiet when it's a lot of snow for some reason.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I like, you send me some pictures, I really like it. I miss I miss this weather in Shanghai, because not really often you can see the snow in Shanghai.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you for agreeing to participate in the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, this is pretty cool.
I was thinking who is gonna be whom I can invite for the next episode, because I just basically it's not, I started it recently, it's only 1 month, because I decided to do something new, like for the fencing, for some fencers, fencing parents, anybody who can listen.
That's a great idea. It's, you know, it's helpful, it's constructive, gives you something to do.
So I sent you already some questions. Like, in general, it's like not a questions, it's gonna be like maybe key points, like where we can talk about them, and yeah, maybe you tell. I'm pretty sure you can tell many things about fencing in generally, and what you do, and
sure,
yeah, some, what do you like to talk about, just talk, and I think it's gonna be interesting.
Okay, great, sounds okay. Good.
All right. Basically, I ask, this is very, I think, the fundamental question, how people start fencing, like when they, how did they find, how did you basically find fencing club, or how did you find out fencing is going to be your sport in your life?
Sure. Before I found fencing, I was doing kendo, which is Japanese sword fighting, for about maybe 2 or 3 years. And okay. I was, before high school, before I went into ninth grade, my friend, my neighbor, who is 1 year ahead of me, he said I should go out for a sport my first year of high school, otherwise I'll be behind. So I saw our high school happen to have a fencing team. And I thought, oh, kendo, fencing, is the same thing. But of course it's not. Technique-wise, nothing is the same. But philosophically, it's exactly the same. So I went out for the fencing team, and I can give you the exact date, because I remember it was November 1st, 1974. So I've been fencing a long time.
Yes, but it's been pretty long time ago, yeah? But you still remember it, yeah?
I remember the very first day, yes.
Okay.
I think because of the kendo, it helped me be successful at fencing early on. Because I've already done one-on-one sport, it helped me to be, you know, aggressive and take risks and basically not be afraid to try.
Okay. Yeah. I really like this sword-related sports like kendo and some. I also like historical fencing, like in general, like how it looks like. So I think it's pretty cool. Pretty cool, yeah.
It is cool. Yeah. That is pretty cool. I think when you're doing sport like fencing, it's so easy to get other people fascinated about it, because a lot of people have heard of it. Everyone's heard of it, but no one's really ever done it. So, okay.
For the people, in majority of people, they don't really, maybe they see it, but they don't understand sometimes what exactly happening, right? So
that's very true. Yeah,
it's our mission as well to share some knowledge, right, about fencing, what's happening on the fencing. Okay, so basically kendo, I think kendo is more, it looks like more like saber, right? Because you need to cut, usually.
Right.
You need to cut your opponent.
Yes, right. In kendo, you only have three targets. It's the head, the forearm, and the torso.
You were doing kendo, and then you decided to do fencing, which is basically also like more modern way to do.
They're both martial arts. So.
Okay, so what's inspired you to do fencing, like for the rest of your life? Almost entire of your life you do fencing. What's the most inspirational thing you found in this sport?
Well, it's a constant evolution of solving problems, which I love to solve problems and, you know, riddles and puzzles and things like that. Except I get to do it in my head and in my body and then to someone else. So I find that very, very satisfying. And I thought this sport was so great. By the time I was a junior in high school, third year, I knew I wanted to be a fencing coach. I knew I wanted to continue to compete and train and get everybody involved in it, as many people as I could.
Okay. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just such a great sport, and one of the big advantages of fencing is that you don't have to be 7 foot tall or throw 100 miles an hour or run a 6.400 yard dash.
Yeah,
you can be many shapes and sizes and heights and body types and still be successful.
Yeah, so basically fencing is an accessible sport for everybody. Everybody can do fencing.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So, I think fencing is also somebody call it a physical chess, right? Because when you are on the strip, when you fencing, you need to decide what's gonna be your next move, right? So you have to have many choices and many decisions when you fencing.
Right. You always have to think ahead and try to be one step ahead of your opponent. Like you said in chess, you do a move, but you know they're going to do something about it, and you have to anticipate what they're going to do as well.
Yeah. I also like you don't need just to be smart. Yeah, you need to kind of be. You need outwit your opponent, right? So you need to understand.
Correct.
Your opponent also wants to win, and You need to predict his actions, right?
Right. Anticipate counteractions and risk rewards.
Yeah.
But and that, all that's on the fly, you know, while you're out there doing it. So, you know, like Saber, you have to kind of plan ahead and then change as you need to. Foil, you and Epe, you can kind of evolve your plan while you're in action.
This is because Saber is much faster, right?
Yes, there's very little time to kind of figure things out on the fly in Saber. Less time. You can, but it's very tricky. Much more difficult in Saber than Foil and Epe.
Yeah, I think Saber is also more like your reflexes, right? So you work out some reflexes. Like, you don't have a time to think. You just have your reflexes, especially when you, for example, when your opponent suddenly try to press you, yeah, so you need to just react. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a good point about Saber. Okay. So moving forward to the next key point of our conversation. So you are fencer, you are fencing coach, you are a mentor, so you're mentoring and other people to improve their all their abilities, right? So basically, you do like many things which is kind of related to each other, but from the other hand, they are quite different. And also, you're actor, right? Sometimes you need to do some I don't know how to say it, like your professional activity. When you're an actor, you need to train your vocal, you need to train how to talk properly. So how basically all these activities you do, how they help each other? Yeah, how you apply them, like for example, how you apply fencing for your actoring activities, from the other hand, how you apply your actoring skills on the fencing piste?
That's actually an interesting question, because I never realized how similar acting was to competing. In acting, we have rehearsals. In fencing, we have practice. In acting, we have performance. And in fencing, we have tournaments. Yeah. And in training for acting classes, most of the other people in the classes were not competitive athletes. So the mental preparation things that we did for acting class, I've been doing for years to prepare for tournaments.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a thing for a big revelation to how to prepare for performing in class. It's like warming up, and you warm up for practice every day. You warm up for tournaments every tournament, and we warm up for class every day in acting, and people weren't used to that. So I felt that I had a big advantage in learning faster because I got to kind of go past that step.
Yeah.
It also teaches me how to control myself, my emotions, and what emotions I want to show and what emotions I don't want to show, whether it's to my opponent. I don't want to tell them I'm angry or afraid or have doubt. I can't show that to my opponent. That's gives them too much advantage. And acting has taught me to channel what I want to expose and what I want to keep. And I didn't realize it was until one of the acting coaches said it was like playing sports. And she made all these correlations between the two. And I found that, wow, this is acting is a sport. I mean, the way you look at it generally, it is you train, you prepare, you warm up, you perform, and I'm like, that sounds like fencing.
Okay, yeah, that's, I think, yeah, I agree with you. I haven't been an actor yet. Maybe I'm gonna try it at some point.
Everybody should try it.
Yeah, taking your exam. But I think it's also, you know, it's very, like, competitive thing, yeah. So many people maybe they dream to be an actor, yeah. So sometimes it's like you also have to have some maybe talent, right? So when you are an actor, sometimes you need to work it out, but I think sometimes you need to have part of the talent, right? So your natural ability to smile, right, to speak and to show your gestures, show your face to the camera, right?
Yeah, I think also, like in fencing, your talent can be trained. Mm-hmm. If you have training, you will learn how to smile and present yourself and speak. And you trained to be an actor just like you trained to be a fencer. The process of preparing for a shoot or a tournament is really, it's just plain hard work on both sides. There's no way to just, somebody says, oh, I'm a natural. Yeah, up to a point. Mm-hmm. And that is an advantage. But after that, you need training and more guidance than actual physical training. So I find that acting and fencing has helped my acting, which I, of course, started later in life. And I think if it can work for acting, it can work for a lot of other areas. And I sent you a video about the applications of preparing for events.
Yeah,
and you know, whether it's the in the classroom or doing a presentation or in the courtroom or operating room or whatever room profession they end up taking, they'll know how to emotionally and mentally prepare to do the thing that they need to do because they've done it in tournaments.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, generally talking about tournaments. Mm-hmm. So. You as athlete, I just checked the United States Association of Fencing, or like United States Fencing Association, right? So I check your page. So there is a lot of your results shown. So you were participating in a few world championships, right?
And, veterans, yeah. And actually, senior.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Okay. But maybe it's on the second page because I was watching only first page. So it's quite a lot of Pan American championships, some world championship. So the best, the highest place on the world, it was sixth place, right? So we got to top eight. So what you can say about this result? Basically, I think it's quite good because you got to the top eight. It's I think it's very good to be number six in the world in anything. I think if you're number six in the world, it's already a nice thing, right? But maybe from another hand, it was a bit disappointing because you could do better, right? What do you think about this particular competition?
You are exactly right on my feelings. At the time, I was angry because I knew I could beat that guy. Mm-hmm. And he was good. He was very smart. And he ended up, I think he took second place in the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So he continued to win after me. But I'm like, I look at him, I was like, oh man, I could beat that guy. There's just, if I had held my head together longer and made a couple of changes, it would have been me up there instead of him. But afterwards, you know, you look back and you say, okay, well, sixth place, you know, that's my highest result and it's pretty good and I should be, and I was happy with it, but it took a while realize it, to say, okay, that was okay, instead of, dang it, I wish I had done this or done that. All due respect to my opponent, he just was smarter than me in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I'm pretty satisfied, you know. Hopefully do better next time.
So, yeah. So I think if you can get the time machine, so you could get back to that bout, right? And you could make some changes, yeah? Which could help you to win that match. Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So can you, remember what was your favorite competition career, and what was the brightest memory from your career as athlete?
I don't know. I really, every time I do well in tournament is always my favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
it's gratifying not just because I, you know, the winning isn't as, well, it's rewarding, but to me, it's the fencing well. It's to me, the executing my ideas, the way I pictured it. That's my gratification. The medal is nice, it's great. But if I fence well, I find that the best tournament. Sometimes my result isn't that great, but I feel like I fenced well, and sometimes people just fence better than you on any given day. Mm-hmm. Or you run into somebody that's just hard, but I think overcoming the difficult fencers, because sometimes they're not always very good, but they're just hard to fence.
Yeah.
For me, that's my gratification. That's how I get my satisfaction out of competition, is my performance. And then there's the result, whatever it ends up being, which is a very close second. Mm-hmm. But it's still my how I perform matters to me.
So basically, you consider the victory from another way, like from the point of view of your fencing quality, right?
Yes.
So if you show good quality of fencing, you are happy already, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the result is kind of side effect. Yeah. So if you win, it's gonna be, could be nice bonus to your good fencing at the competition, right?
Yeah, I feel like if you fence well, the medals will come, and you just have to keep focusing on fencing well and not getting a medal.
I think this is a very good thing to tell to students. Maybe sometimes they feel some stress, some pressure before competition, right? So I think if you focus on your fencing, not on the goal, your goal is not to win, your goal is to fence, right? So it can remove some stress, right? You can calm down and focus all your strengths to the good fencing, doing right actions, right? Okay.
Because most of your good performance is within your control. So you can control whether you panic or you're afraid or you're hungry, you know, you're tired, you know, it's like, hey, you're tired, like, I'm sorry, so what, you have to fence. It's like, yeah, I'm hungry, it's like, oh, sorry, you have to fence now.
Okay.
So it's within your control how you can perform. And when you do it and do it well, it's very satisfying.
Yeah, okay. So the next question, basically, I'm a bit messed up with questions because I sent you some questions, so I guess... I skipped one, and I just find out I skipped it. But don't worry, we just talk. Yeah, don't worry about this.
Yeah. No, we just, somewhere along the line, it'll probably work itself into our conversation.
Yeah. I think, as I said before, like two fencers every time can find a way, find a thing to talk about, right? So it's like,
absolutely.
You don't know where a conversation can take us. Who knows?
Right.
All right. So now you're doing basically in Chicago. You are doing. You are helping some students, some fencers from the other countries. You help them to apply for their U.S. universities, right?
Yes.
Yes, I got it correctly. So you help them, and So can you tell something about this? Like what the
Sure.
What they need to do to apply, and when they need to start? Do they need to start like very early when they are in the junior school, for example, or they need to wait until the last year? And what the first steps and first requirements for the applying?
Okay. First, I want to take a step back and talk about who I'm trying to help, because originally, I was going to do this for U.S. kids in the U.S. To help them, shepherd them through how to get recruited and who to talk to and how to prepare.
Okay.
But for two years, I went around national tournaments and I talked to coaches and I look at kids and I see that I don't know if they really need my help, because they have access to coaches more than kids who live overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And they can take a weekend to go visit a campus. They see the coaches at national tournaments 5-6 times a year. So that's, I felt like, maybe American kids don't need my help. So then I looked to help kids who are living abroad, and some of the kids living abroad are U.S. citizens. They just live somewhere else.
Yeah.
And some of them are not. And I thought, okay, these are the kinds of people who really don't have access and don't have information readily available to them. And so I started helping them when I was in Shanghai. And it's actually since COVID, and there's no tournaments and there's no on-campus visits. Now everybody seems to be like in the same boat, that they're isolated from being able to access coaches and campuses. So I've been helping more American kids too. But one of the things that most people don't know is that once you enter high school, is when you can start looking at fencing colleges. It's a really young age to determine, you know, what your major is going to be, what you're going to, where you're going to go to school. But the process can just lay down some groundwork where you don't have to make those decisions yet, and do some preparations on setting up things that you only have to update instead of build once you get closer to junior, sophomore, junior year. And I help them put things together and register in the right places and how to present themselves. So it's a process that they can start tinkering about it in eighth grade, but by the time freshman year comes, they should start, technically according to NCAA, they're considered prospects, but they're not recruitable until their junior year, which means coaches can talk to them about, oh, this is the university, you can learn this, this is where we are in the country, and but they can't talk about their fencing programs yet until their junior year.
Okay,
11th grade.
What's the junior year? It's like exactly some age, or it's when you enter grade 8, right? So you can start.
11.
Grade 11, okay.
Yes, and we enter September 1st of 11th grade. No matter what age you are, coaches can start now to talk more about their programs and coming, you know, looking at their university. They can't sign anything yet, but they can sort of say, yeah, I really like this school. You know, when I start applying in senior year, this is going to be my number one choice. And that number one choice can evolve from time to time, you know, because things change. The kids decide maybe they want to study this instead of that. And the coaches and universities have been changing a lot in the last few years. So that kind of is a deciding factor. It's an ongoing process that never really is stable. It's very mysterious to parents and to kids, and even to me sometimes. I don't know how things get done, but one thing that everybody is concerned about, including coaches, is that the admissions process is very, very fickle.
Okay,
that means it's very unpredictable.
So it all depends on the situation, right? Sometimes the rules can change.
Yes.
Yeah. So you need to be prepared to adjust, right?
Right. Rules can change with the NCAA, with the individual institution.
Yeah.
Coach may have their own ideas, and then the kids could change their minds. So it's an ongoing evolution of problem solving, which is the perfect thing for me.
Okay. So basically, you help to solve all these problems. Right?
Yeah.
Potentially.
I try to position them to have the best position possible. And then we see what we can do.
Okay. So basically, when they come to 11th grade, so they can start searching for the college, right? For the future. And so basically, they can contact you directly, or how it works usually. So if for example me, I'm the student, I'm at grade 11, so what I need to do to start my start to look for some potential colleges, so what I need to do to do this?
Well, to one step back is that kids can start looking anytime.
Okay.
To college, it's just like their coaches can't recruit them until 11th grade. So the kids could have an idea of who it is they want to talk to already by the time they're in 11th grade.
Okay.
But if they want to have help and to increase their chances for admissions and in the university, fencing can help do that. But I really am not interested in somebody who's fencing just to get into college.
Mm-hmm.
Can I go over my criteria for who ideal person I'd like to help?
All right. Yes.
Because
okay.
Number one, there's only five.
Okay.
The number one criteria is that they have to love fencing and be committed to it. That's
right.
Number one.
The most important.
Number two.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I don't want somebody who go into college and then quit because
right.
they're burnt out or they don't want to do it. So they have to really just intrinsically want to do it.
Okay.
The second thing is that they have to be of excellent moral and ethical character. Fortunately, in the sport of fencing, that's not really a problem. Everybody is really pretty much good person and have good ethics.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike other sports, we are very fortunate to have good quality people and families that are involved with fencing.
All right.
They have to be a pretty good student, especially if they're coming from overseas. That way they have more choices.
You mean they have to be like polite and very calm, or like what do you mean under the moral and ethical qualities?
They have to work hard.
Okay.
They have to work hard, as not be lazy. They have to help others, which is good leadership skills anyway.
Okay.
They have to be honest, you know, and trustworthy, because
mm-hmm.
you don't show up to practice one day and you don't tell the coach. Coach is going to say, "Hey, what's going on?"
Mm-hmm.
And you say, "Oh, I had a test and I had to study," you know. And they have to learn the process. You have to tell the coach you have a test, and the coaches. 9 out of 10 times, okay, go study for the test, come back tomorrow, you know, and because you are in college, you are
mm-hmm.
a student athlete in that order.
Yeah.
So you can't do much if you're not keeping your grades up and keeping up with your schoolwork. So they are very accommodating to your academic requirements.
Okay. Okay.
So that comes into being the next one, being a good student, and by being a good student. That basically means having good habits, knowing when to study and when you can go out and have fun, and you know, and being disciplined in accomplishing the objectives of your academic requirements.
Yeah, so you have to be responsible for your life and for your actions, right? So you need to do things in the right time, have a nice time management, I guess, right?
Exactly. That's an excellent
okay.
time management, and that kind of goes into their ethics, you know, ethics and moral characters. You know, they know what to do, and they do what they should be doing. They have to know English, because in some of the foreign countries, English is mostly taught, but sometimes some are better at it than others. So they have to be proficient in English, because coming to the U.S. and English isn't strong is
mm-hmm.
going to be a struggle.
It's going to be a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last one is they have to be financially capable of handling the tuition and all expenses, because foreign students get very little to no financial aid. And
okay.
that's kind of a... If they're speaking English and living in a foreign country, chances are they're pretty affluent families and they can manage the finances of going to college. It's just not easy to get financial aid, or impossible to get financial aid
mm-hmm.
if you're a foreign student.
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, so even if you are a very good fencer, so it's still hard, right?
Yeah, and,
mm-hmm.
and that gets to my last point, is that none of my criteria say you have to be a top fencer, although it's great if you are, and it certainly does help a lot. But to me, all these personal qualities matter equally or more, actually, more than being a top fencer, because sometimes top fencers don't fulfill the rest of these criteria,
mm-hmm.
and they might struggle if they got to the U.S. English wise or training wise or school wise. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go have anybody go where they're not going to be successful, not going to just survive but to thrive there, because the coach is going to be like, hey Ed, what's this person you sent to me? You know, they're not coming to practice, they're not going to class, and that's a big problem for everyone.
Okay, yeah.
So being a top fencer is great, and I hope everybody, you know, who works hard at it has their success in their fencing. But I feel also if you have these qualities, you have great potential to improve in college.
Yeah, that I makes sense. Okay, so let's run it again. So the first is they should love fencing, right?
Love fencing and be committed to it.
Yeah, be committed to fencing. And number two is they have to have excellent moral and ethic qualities, right? So hard
yes.
work, leadership, be honest.
Honesty.
Okay.
Trustworthy.
Yes. Okay. And the third criteria, it was financial stability, right? They have to be financial.
Third one was good student.
Okay, good student.
Which means good time management, good study habits.
It's basically very related to second, right? So if you are a good student, you also have a good moral and good
ethics. Yeah, generally.
Yeah, so yeah. So good student.
I agree.
Fourth was financial stability, right?
Fourth was English.
Yeah, good English, yeah. I just put a good English to the second. Okay, so good English, good English and good student, financially stable, and excellent moral qualities, and the most important, they should love and they should be committed to fencing, right?
Yes, absolutely.
They should love what they do and do what they love, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's right. Because, if somebody is fencing just to get into college and then they get into the school that they want, I'm concerned that they may say, oh, my goal is accomplished and fencing has served its purpose and mm-hmm. I'm done with fencing, you know. But, you know, we want somebody who wants to continue to fence because they love it.
Yeah, and of course.
Because they have to and not certainly not to stop.
Okay, so basically in U.S. colleges, when they fence for the university, right, mm-hmm. how many times per week usually they train?
Well, each coach runs their own show. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean they decide how to set the schedule. The NCAA has a maximum amount of any athletically related activities to 20 hours a week, mm-hmm. maximum.
Okay.
Most fencing doesn't hit that. When I was at Northwestern, we got, I think the most we had was 15. And that included mm-hmm. weight and conditioning outside of practice, mm-hmm. regular training, and outside private lessons. And there's film and, you know, seminars, the nutrition, things like that, mm-hmm. That also count into it, but those aren't on a regular basis. But the strength and conditioning and private lesson and group training mm-hmm. were the three main consumers of those 15 hours.
15 hours. That's not too much, I think. It's quite average number, right?
Some schools do less. Mm-hmm. Some schools do more. It really depends on the coach's how he schedules training.
Okay.
But it's not actually the team's practice; it's the individual's practice. So some aren't required to go to practice every day because they switch foil one day, saber another, epic another, mm-hmm. and then together another. So yeah, it really is all over the place. As long as it's not more than 20 hours a week.
Okay, so basically, yeah, so it's on the coach. Yeah, coach decides what he would like to do. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense. All right, Ed, that was pretty clear, I think. Yeah, so it's going to be very interesting for the listeners who would like to go to yes, maybe. Maybe it's going to be some... okay, so
sure.
You were working... basically, in Shanghai. So we were working uh-huh. in Shanghai at a fencing club. It was about 1 year, right? So you were
yeah.
You
just
came,
under a year.
Yeah, you came in 2015, and then you left it 1 year later. So,
yeah.
And when I came to China, actually, I met many people who also know you, and so basically, I heard your name many times, but I didn't.
Oh, no.
I didn't really contact you because you were already in US. Okay, so what you can say about fencing in China and how you can compare it to American fencing, and do you have some feeling like Chinese fencing development is going towards like American system, or it's still like different, because in China is kind of two ways to grow. Yeah, some people go to sports school and they do it very professionally, almost every day they train hard, and some people they kind of amateur, but sometimes some people also quite strong. Yeah, so it's kind of
yes,
two branches of the fencing in China. So how you can
yes,
compare Chinese fencing with American?
Like you said, there's like two different fencing worlds in the same country. The private clubs, well, at Sika, the club we were both at different
yeah,
times, I looked at the schedule for training, and they have, you know, the group classes and the private lessons and who's giving what lesson and all that. But
mm-hmm,
there was no allocated time for free fencing, open bouting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, when is the open bouting? And they all look at me like, what is that? And I said, that's when people come in and they just do, they can take lesson maybe also, but they just do free fencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that wasn't part of the schedule. And I finally got them to do it on Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, open bouting is for anybody from any club. We want anybody from any club who wants to come to fence. And there was like, I got a lot of resistance from administration saying that they did not want others, outsiders, to come to our bouting. And I'm like, why? We learned from them. It's just, well, they're going to, I don't know. We don't have any secret moves or something that we don't show anybody or
yeah,
anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they felt like it was very secular. It's us and them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no, we learn from each other. And maybe we have club match.
Yeah,
you know, just for fun, you know, but they weren't very interested in that. And
mm-hmm,
I think the open bouting was missing in a lot of private clubs. And I think U.S. clubs all have open bouting.
Mm-hmm.
And during open bouting is private lessons. They just take them out and the coach will get a lesson. And then they go back into bouting and picks another student. And then they also have footwork, usually group classes as well. So it's kind of opposite of the structure of the Chinese clubs.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost only classes. And then there's the sports world, the sports school world, where they are professionals and their job is to study something sport related and train in the sport that they're in as their major, basically, as their study
mm-hmm,
major.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
I wish that the two worlds would have competitions that include both.
So they kind of meet each other in the middle.
Yes, yes. And then you see, you know, sometimes there's a private school fencer who's very strong and can break into the final or even win a national tournament that was only open to sports kids before. And I know that's probably very scary to the sports world because they don't want to think like they're doing a bad job, but I also think it could inspire them to say, wow, you know, we should make changes in our training, because private clubs are usually foreign coaches.
Yeah.
And sports school is almost exclusively Chinese coaches.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
So that's a big difference. And the size of competitions, the numbers are, to me, the Chinese tournament size is insane on American standards. For them to have, you know, 2,000 fencers in a weekend
mm-hmm,
is a crazy number. But somehow they get it done. And they're very efficient and they're very what's the word?
Yeah.
They don't waste time, and somehow they finish. And I'm like, how did that happen? And I was very amazed at how well they run tournaments.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
but isn't it crazy how big an event could be?
Yeah, you said it was 2,000. I remember it was more than 3,000 once. No.
Yes, so and that's like not uncommon. Everyone's like, yeah, we have 3,000. I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, it's that's a normal number. I'm like, oh my god. That's like,
yeah, they can manage.
We'd be going crazy in the U.S. So if there was a tournament with 3,000 kids. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how many people usually come to NAC?
Well, NAC runs a huge number of events each weekend. So each event may have anywhere from, I don't know, the older veterans events probably have like maybe 15, 20 entries. Mm-hmm. And then the cadets and juniors could have 300. So, and that could happen in one weekend over usually three days, or sometimes 4 days, could be several thousand people, but lots and lots of small events.
Mm-hmm.
In China, I think the biggest event was Y10, right?
Mm.
Was that the biggest one? Or
Y10? Y10 is like a Chinese fencing league stop. Or...
Yes. The Y10 had the biggest numbers, I thought. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And it seems to drop off dramatically once it gets to Y14, when the kids enter high school. It goes from, like, Y12 will have, Y10 will have 3,000, the Y12 will have 2,000, and the Y14 will have, like, 40.
Yeah, somehow they get some, they drop, maybe because they do it too much, or maybe they have a lot of academic pressure, right? So they need to drop fencing. Yeah.
I think that's the number one reason is parents and kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what Chinese academic curriculums are like, but they say, oh yeah, there's too much school to continue fencing, so a lot of them stop in high school, which is unfortunate because in the U.S. a lot of them start in high school and start competing nationally in high school. But when I started, it was high school was the beginning. And now it's 8 years old is the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they start very early and finish early as well.
Mm.
Yeah, makes. All right, so basically, open bouting is a very important thing of fencing development. I mean, experience exchange. Experience exchange and just practice with many people. Yeah, it's very important.
Right, variety, right?
Yeah, and. Yeah, in China, much bigger number. But sometimes, I must say, sometimes it's a bit messy because they don't know. Basically, they know, but they don't start it on time in China very often. So there was many occasions we were waiting a lot. For example, a few hours, and some students had to warm up 3-4 times, you know. So I think when many people come into competition, it's a good thing. But from the other hand, it's kind of challenging for the organizers to arrange everything.
Also, they're very fluid with the competition dates.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the kids said, oh yeah, we're going to have a national tournament on this weekend. Mm-hmm. And then they changed it like 2 weeks before the tournament. They said, oh, we're going to have it this weekend instead. Yeah. And everybody just goes with it. I'm just like, wow. You have a date in the U.S. That's when it is. There's no changing it, really.
Yeah. You have to be. Yeah, that's one rule I developed. You need to be prepared for sudden changes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Yeah, okay. It was something I wasn't used to, and I'd never heard of any national tournament. Maybe local one, but national changed the date, and I was like, wow.
Okay. So, do you miss Shanghai? Do you want to come back?
Yeah. You know what? I do. I do miss Shanghai. Mm-hmm. I really, it was a very difficult time adjusting because the culture is so different.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I know what it's like, I know what to expect, and I don't feel it's going to be so conflicting with what I'm used to because I know it's going to be different. And this is, I know now how it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. So when it is, it's not going to be so, what is going on?
Yeah.
So I I do miss Shanghai, and I really met some wonderful people there. And the city is beautiful, and it's full of, I thought, very nice people. I mean, everybody, whether they spoke English or not, I thought that they were all trying to be very nice and accommodating. I look Chinese, so people always expect me to, they think I'm Chinese. And then when I start speaking English, I have the same conversation. It's like, whoa, you know, just like, yeah.
Yeah, so they kind of, That was many occasions they speak Chinese with you, right?
Yeah, at the beginning, and but I really appreciated how accommodating they were, and Chinese hospitality is wonderful, and not just families, but professionally. I mean, the professional hospitality at hotels and restaurants and things was really, maybe it's just the places I went to because I was a foreigner, but it was really very accommodating and very friendly and very... a lot of fun. It was very, very comfortable to be there.
Yeah, I think it's still a lot of fun now. But of course, last year, for some reasons, we know which reasons, but it was difficult. But in generally now it's okay and everything is fine. So except everybody needs to wear mask, of course. But in general, it's coming back to normal slowly. I hope.
Yeah, hope so.
How about U.S.? Is it getting a bit better day by day?
It is. It's improving a little bit. And I guess even if it stayed the same, I would consider that an improvement from the way it was going. But I believe it's actually declining little by little. And that's a good sign. Vaccinations have been happening more often and people are getting more comfortable. And not so scared about things. And so I think things are going in a good direction. And hopefully, they said by summer, things might be much, much better.
So they're gonna...
But we see.
They will try to vaccinate. It's supposed to be like 70%, yeah, at least, so people can get immune in general, right? From 70.
Yeah. Yeah. When they count the U.S. population, they also count children, which don't get vaccinated. So when they say 70%, that could be all the adults. I don't know how many. I don't know what the exact proportion is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hopefully it's gonna be okay. Or
yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I'm
hoping so.
Yeah. Okay. So the last question, like maybe you remember some funny occasion from the competitions or from the training. You can tell us. So we can. Do you have any story, like funny story?
I think one of the funniest things that I remember is that at a tournament that Seiko was holding, when there was priority, we actually have scoring machines that determines priority by flashing back and forth. Some referees toss a coin and some referees spin a pencil. But in China, I saw that the two fencers get together and they do rock, paper, scissors to determine priority.
Oh.
And I thought that was hilarious. I thought that was...
Oh,
that
yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
That was fun, you know?
I never seen this. Maybe it's like some very smart guy invented this thing.
And, you get the young kids doing rock, paper, scissors, and they try to do rock, paper, and then they wait until they see the other ones, and then they do their sign. I'm like, no, you guys can't do it at the same time.
Yeah, but in this way you can cheat your opponent, right? You can wait.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, it's very tricky, but no, you can't do it that way.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and I thought, you know what? We should do that in the U.S. At least you feel like you have some control over how it turns out, even though you really don't. But it feels like you do. And we should do priority rock paper scissors. Go.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. All right, Edward, thank you for this interview. I think it was amazing, and it was very nice to have you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. It's good to talk to you again. And thank you, by the way, for coming up and finding me at the World Championships in Wuxi, where we met face-to-face for the first time.
Yeah. I
appreciate that.
I think you said a lot of things. It's interesting personally for me, but I think if somebody... is gonna listen, I'm gonna put advertisement in many social media, in WeChat, in LinkedIn, Facebook. So hopefully many people can listen. Yeah. And also, if they have some questions, they can contact you in Facebook, right? So where is the best way to contact you?
I have an email address that I can send to you that I use for just the fencing mentoring and coaching and things like that. I can send that to you.
Okay. Okay, so you send it to me, inform everybody. And so who wanna apply for US college need to contact you by email, right? And you gonna talk about all the details.
Yeah. And see, you know, if they have, you know, they think, there might be schools that they would be a good fit for that they never even heard of. And I believe that I think that there's a lot out there that just is so unknown. It's worth at least asking about.
All right, Ed. Thank you very much again for everything. And
thank you so much. Yeah.
All right. Bye. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take it easy. We'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. I hope this conversation was interesting and useful for everybody who gets to the end, right? So if you have any questions to add, you can contact him by email. I'm gonna spell this email to you in case you cannot check it anywhere, yeah? So the email of Ed is ekaihatsu@ekmentoring.com. I'm gonna spell it letter by letter. It's ekaihatsu@ekmentoring.com. Alright, so you can email to Ed directly and ask him any questions, especially if your question is about applying to United States University. And if you have questions to me, you also can send me message or leave your comments in description. Don't forget to subscribe for my YouTube channel. Also, we have Instagram page. It's also Incredible Fencing. And recently I made a Telegram channel. You also can subscribe. I'm gonna upload there some news. And of course, the Incredible Fencing podcast website, it's incrediblefencing.blueberry.net, or you can just Google Incredible Fencing and you can find it on the first page. All right, so I think it's time to say bye-bye and see you next week and have a nice day. You were listening to Incredible Fencing Podcast. For more information, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, visit my Instagram page or website.